905 and 2005 UTC right after the international news.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sunny Young in Washington. Welcome to the June 8th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's kick off with African men's football. South Africa will host Uganda Thursday in a friendly international match at the FNB Stadium near Johannesburg. Both teams failed to qualify for next year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Cameroon, and they're using the match to prepare for their World Cup qualification campaigns. Now, Thursday's game will be the first in charge for South Africa's new Belgian coach, Hugo Broos. The Ugandan Cranes, meanwhile, are led by interim coach Abdallah Mubiru. Magume Davis Rakawinge visited the Cranes ahead of their trip to South Africa, and he joins us now from Kampala, Uganda. Sporty greetings, Magume.
Sporty greetings to you too, Sunny, and our listeners. Uganda Cranes players train under the watchful eye of interim head coach Abdallah Mubiru at Philip Omondi Stadium, Lugogo, in Kampala, ahead of their friendly encounter with South Africa's Bafana Bafana this Thursday. The squad has a blend of youth and some senior players, including a chunk of those that represented the country in the under-20 AFCON finals, where Uganda finished second. Coach Mubiru says players are in good spirits, competing for a spot to start the game. Mubiru admits it won't be an easy game, but he says the future is bright for the Uganda Cranes.
A good number of senior members retired from the team, so we have to replace them with the youth. Most of them have just represented the country in AFCON under 20, but we are creating a new task in the team, and we have to lean it towards the success the country achieved in Africa Cup of Nations under 20, whereby our boys went up to the finals. We can't just take that for granted. So it is, we can build from that success we achieved to now build it higher and higher.
Five under 20 team players, including captain Bobosi Byaruhanga, graduated to the national team.
What I can say, I'm ready to compete with my fellow players here on the national team so that they can be selected.
Under 20 AFCON top scorer, Derek Kakoza, is also excited to have been summoned, and he says he has what it takes to repeat his scoring antics for the senior national team.
I want to thank the Almighty God, because this is a big achievement in my life. I thank my coaches, my teammates, federation, media, and all my supporters and fans. So I promise I'm going to work very hard to achieve my dreams so that I can play national team.
The Cranes' new captain, Emmanuel Okwi, who plays club football for Egyptian side Al Ittihad Alexandria Club, welcomed the new boys in the national team setup. He says he has already consulted with retired captain Dennis Onyango for guidance.
It's going to be a tough game because South Africa is a very good team, but we're going to prepare with the new boys that have come in and the old ones. We merge together and make sure that we do our best to get a very positive result. As the captain, I told them that they are most welcome. The new boys that have joined us today, they're most welcome and they should feel free. Everyone is welcome here. We should all respect each other from the eldest to the youngest, and we work together and push the national team forward. I think it's a very good game because South Africa also didn't qualify for Africa Cup and they have something to prove, and we also have something to prove. We have new boys coming in. We need to push them and fight together and make sure we get something positive, because I think if we get something positive from South Africa, it will give us confidence going into the World Cup qualifiers in September.
Goalkeeper Mathias Chigonya, who plays for Tanzania club Azam FC, says all members have the task to fill the boots with the departing comrades.
If you look in the team around, so many people are young blood, and I think everyone will push, because it's every player's dream to pray for his nation, and we've got the opportunity. I think we should deliver to be part of the goalkeepers who are going to present the nation.
Uganda Cranes coach Mobilu says we'll focus on the positives from the encounter with Bafana Bafana.
It's now a new setup. What I believe and think that probably at the end of it all, we are going to have a team. Because our task into this game here is about preparing a team that will be ready by the time we play World Cup qualifier.
The Uganda Cranes will begin the World Cup qualifier in September away against the East African rivals, Kenya's Harambee Stars. For the Sunday Side of Sports, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakaringi in Kampala, Uganda.
Hello listeners, my name is Kakwaza Delik, a member of Uganda IPOS Under-20 AFCON Finals as its runners-up, and I was top scorer with 5 goals. Listen to the Sunday Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Gambia's Football Federation is coming under fire for corruption over unfinished FIFA-sponsored projects. Pandari Mbai is following the story. Sporty greetings, Pandari!
Sporting greetings, Sonny. It was back in 2016 when the international football body FIFA had disbursed millions of dollars to help build mini stadiums for the Gambia. But to the soccer football fans, they couldn't understand what is responsible for the slow pace of the project. The project is still lingering. Lamin Jase is the general secretary for the Gambia Football Federation.
FIFA disbursed money to national associations in two folds. One is what is called operational support, and this is to all national associations, 211. The operational support is $1 million, 500 comes in January, and in January to the other one comes in July. So, but before you get the other 500, there are conditions that you need to meet.
And what are those conditions?
For example, you have to play 4 international matches at senior level, 4 international matches at U20 and U17 level. Your national league, you have to play at least 90 games. You have to organize school football. That's why you've been hearing secondary school sports and all those things. You have to organize about 10 referees training.
Among those spearheading the campaign for accountability at the GFF are the former Gambian international footballers. They are not happy with the way the GFF is handling FIFA-sponsored football development projects. They spoke on Freedom Radio Gambia, an online internet radio. But Jase says the projects are on course.
All these projects, for example, GFF, we appoint a consultant. So a consultant is the one that represents us. The consultant then is responsible for recruiting the contractor. And then the contractor is the one that is giving the job to work. Unfortunately, in Gunjur, the contractor we gave the job, the consultant selected, could not deliver, and he was fired.
The football body says efforts are underway to complete the mini stadiums. It asserts that FIFA's funds are not only properly managed, but accounted for.
No one stole the money. That one I can say for sure. And then even also for the procurement, all these things are published. They are on the public domain. Each time we sign a contract or whatever, we publish it on our website, and then the newspapers will also pick it up. And I can tell you, there is even a transparent system in place. FIFA money, nobody can just play with FIFA money like that. These are monitored. You know, these are things, reports are written, and then there are physical supervisions being done.
Jase says GFF cannot escape accountability.
We have a FIFA office in Dakar that is the next door here, and they do come for side visiting. The FIFA Secretary General, Fatima Samura, was here during the Ramadan. We had iftar together. She, you know, had the opportunity to even look at the swimming pool that we were building in our thing. So what we say on paper, she saw it physically also on the ground.
Now the million-dollar question is, what is responsible for the slow pace of the project? Jassy had this to say.
Now FIFA has very stringent, very, very, very strict. In fact, some of those strict measures may have even led, because you asked what led to the delay, may have even led to the delay of some of the projects. Because what it is, you have to present a report, a certified report, and they have to be sure about it. And that also go through so many processes before they release the money, the second installment to come.
Jassy is taking hit for building a story building. His critics are going after him, questioning the source of his new story building.
I spent 11 years in Europe working. I came to Gambia in 2018. So is it not possible that I have maybe gathered some money? You see, that's too personal. I don't want to get into my personal life. But what is important is if the person thinks that he has evidence of corruption or whatsoever, I think the best thing you do in cases like that is putting forward, but not just making mere allegations because the person is building a story building, and that means his GFF, his person is corrupt. I think that is out of the place.
The Gambia Football Federation president, Lamin Kabayabajo, was earlier contacted for comment, but he said he was busy attending to his sick mother. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Pandering by Reporting.
Sporty greetings. This is Ike Diagu, captain of the Nigerian men's national basketball team. You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Thanks.
Thanks, Ike. In National Basketball Association playoff action Monday night, the Phoenix Suns beat the visiting Denver Nuggets 122-105 in the opening game of their second round series. The Suns shined with a balanced scoring attack. Four of their five starters scored 20 or more points, led by forward Michael Bridges with 23 points. Phoenix's star guard Chris Paul finished with 21 points, including 14 in the fourth quarter. Game two in the best of seven series is Wednesday night in Phoenix, Arizona. In Brooklyn, New York, the Brooklyn Nets blew out the Milwaukee Bucks to take a 2-0 lead in that second round series. The AP's Mike Mancuso reports.
The Nets have grabbed the first two games of this second-round playoff series with a 125-86 win over Milwaukee. Playing without James Harden, who strained his hamstring in Game 1, Brooklyn dominated from the start, building a 24-point halftime lead. The Nets were strong defensively against the NBA's leading offense, which pleased coach Steve Nash.
The guys have worked hard at it this year, trying to find our best kind of level defensively, what works for us, how we can refine and improve it. Tonight was exceptional, but our defense has been pretty solid.
Offensively, the Nets used constant ball movement. They hit 21 three-pointers. Kevin Durant scored 32 points.
We didn't get a lot of plays perfect, but we made the second and third efforts, and they didn't destroy us on the offensive rebound, so that showed that we were in box now. That was an emphasis for us. But for the most part, we just did what we were supposed to do, went two at home. Now we got to see if this game is going to travel on the road for us, and we got to stay locked in.
Mike Mancuso, New York.
Thanks, Mike. Ben Golliver is the national NBA writer for the Washington Post newspaper, and Ben has a new book out, Bubble Ball, a book about the NBA bubble last season in Florida. Dan Friedel asked Ben, how did you put the book together?
It became very clear to me early on during the pandemic, this was going to be a life-changing moment, a career-altering type moment, in part because professional sports were hit so hard, right? And when they shut down in March 2020, we had no idea when they were going to come back. And my entire life since 2007 has really revolved around the NBA schedule. You know, like I never spend Christmas with my family because I'm always covering an NBA game. I always take vacations in August because that's the only time the season is not going on. And so, you know, the pandemic hit me really hard. As soon as the arenas were closed, I was, you know, kind of going through an existential crisis almost of like, what am I going to do with myself, you know, and dealing with all sorts of stress and anxiety about, well, what does this mean for, the future of the industry and for the sport and everything else. And, you know, as time passed, it became clear, look, I wasn't the only person asking these kinds of questions. You know, people who had a lot more money on the line, you know, riding on the health of professional sports were at work trying to come up with a way that they could play games during the pandemic. And, thankfully, I was one of very few people who was lucky enough to be able to cover the NBA's comeback plan, the bubble down in Disney World, up close and personal from inside that experience. And so I was down there for 93 days, 92 nights. There was a pretty rigorous application process. I had to send in all these health forms and medical information to be able to even get a spot. And then once I was down there, I just really threw myself into the experience. I said, look, 20 years from now, you know, kids are going to be asking each other, wait a minute, LeBron James won a title at Disney World? This makes no sense whatsoever. And so at that point, you know, even before I knew I was going to write the book, I wanted my writing to be sort of like a time capsule for the Washington Post. I wanted people to be able to say, here's what it was like. Here's how the arenas were set up. Here's why there was no fans. Here's what the health rules were. Here's how the security operation worked, so people couldn't really leave the campus to kind of keep everyone safe while we were down there. And, you know, when the idea to write the book came along, I thought, this is perfect. You know, I've been looking for a first book idea for a long time. This one just kind of fell in my lap. I was so intrigued and invested personally, emotionally, and from a time standpoint in that bubble experience. And I thought, look, someone needs to write this book, and it better be me. And so I was really glad that it was. And as soon as I left the bubble, I took 1 week off to clear my head, and I spent the next 3 months just writing my manuscript, and about 2 more months after that, editing it. And now it's out in time for the playoffs. And it's been just really exciting and really fun to hear from basketball fans kind of reliving that experience, you know, in terms of what happened on the court, but also getting to see my perspective of what it was like to go through this experience. And in a lot of places in this book, I do tell the story in the first person because I want fans to kind of, you know, go through what I went through, just kind of like ride along on my shoulder.
What was it like to be in this bubble?
The bubble was isolated from the rest of the world, but everything else that was happening on everywhere, whether it was the social justice movement, whether it was the presidential politics of that 2020 election, you know, whether it was, you know, the rise of voting rights activism, which really became a major, you know, touch point last summer. All of that was just distilled down into that bubble experience because the players were fully invested themselves in it. I mean, a number of the players before they got to Disney World were leading marches, right? Protest marches. They were being very active, and they were some of the first people to raise, you know, the George Floyd's death as a major national news story, to elevate it because he had been such close friends with a former NBA player, Steven Jackson. And then when we were there, the Milwaukee Bucks shutdown is going to be the most memorable aspect of the entire bubble experience, even more so than the Lakers winning the title, because for 3 days, the NBA stopped and a bunch of other professional sports stopped because the Bucks said, hey, you know, this shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin is not okay. We're not comfortable with it. We're not going to just go out there and take the court like everything's okay, because it's not. And I thought their shutdown prompted a lot of discussions, you know, between the owners and the players about the best way to kind of go forward with the bubble. But it also sparked an unbelievable amount of interest globally, not only just in the sports community. I mean, in the 72 hours after their shutdown, we heard from everyone from AOC, you know, all the way up to Jared Kushner on the other side of the political spectrum, right? Everyone was weighing in on this decision. And so I'm not sure if it's going to be remembered quite like the 1968 Olympic protest, but it's going to be up there among the most prominent player-driven protests in sports history. And I think that, you know, it's a great reminder that even though the bubble was physically cut off from the world, I mean, there was 4 layers of security separating all of us in this little island, this little pocket of Disney World, from the rest of Orlando and the rest of Florida. You know, it still became kind of a centerpiece type location, really, for all these conversations that were taking place across the country.
Early in the book, you were talking about your experience of showing up at Disney and realizing that you would be very close to all of these NBA figures that are normally kept at an arm's length during a normal season. You got down there, and certainly there was a lot of security. You weren't really allowed to freely mix with the players. But for example, you mentioned walking past a group of the NBA officials playing a game called pickleball, which is a kind of a hybrid between table tennis and normal tennis. Do you think that shared experience, the fact that you were there with very few people, will be useful and lasting in a connection with the other people who were there? Like, people have high school reunions. Are you going to have a 20-year bubble reunion?
I wouldn't be shocked if that took place. I mean, I think that people who were down there tend to refer to each other kind of like bubble alumni, right? I mean, it's a badge of honor, but it's also, I'm not in a hurry to go back. I'll tell you that much. I mean, if there was a 2-year reunion, I'd probably skip it. I'll just put it that way. But you know, I think that there is a shared bond from everyone who went through that experience. I think a big goal in telling this story was to convey just how challenging it was mentally, because the players, you know, everyone from LeBron James to Paul George and right on down the list, some of the biggest stars in the sport, spent a lot of time talking about, well, this is so difficult. And I think for the common fan, they're thinking, these guys are probably in amazing hotel rooms. They live in mansions. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars. They can order whatever the heck they want on Amazon to make their life more comfortable. It's only 3 months. This could be a situation where, do they come off spoiled if they're complaining? Are they coming off, you know, taking some of these things for granted at a time when lots and lots of people were losing their jobs, right, and undergoing incredible financial duress because of the pandemic? And so I wanted to kind of point out, is like, look, I live in a one-bedroom apartment. I drive a Ford. It's really hard for me, and I don't even have to play. And I was prepared as best I could mentally going into this experience to understand that it would be challenging to live, you know, by yourself, not really able to have interactions with lots of other people while you're on this campus, to not be able to just fly home at a moment's notice if you want to not even be able to drive a car down the road if you want to do that as well. I mean, there was very limited opportunities to just get your mind off things. And so, you know, when I was down there, and I've been pretty honest about this, I mean, I put on weight, I slept terribly, my stress and anxiety was up, and I felt really disconnected from the outside world. And you know, in August, there was wildfires back in my home state of Oregon, and my parents, you know, were thankfully not directly impacted by it, but there was all sorts of smoke all over the city, you know, near Portland where they live, and they were just having a terrible time saying, we can't even go outside and get walks now. This pandemic just keeps getting worse and worse. There was no way for me to comfort them, you know, during that experience, because I'm stuck here in this, you know, post-apocalyptic amusement park where there's nobody's on the rides. We can't even go to the rides. I mean, it's just a completely empty place, right? So those things were really hard. I was always very grateful that I knew the end date, right? I was down there for 93 days, 92 nights. I mean, if it was indefinite, I think it would have been even more challenging. And I think it's no surprise, no secret that the players, that this was a one and done thing. They didn't want to do a bubble sequel, right? They did not want to do this current NBA season down there again. And that's why you saw them actually put up with hundreds of positive tests during the course of this season. That's why you saw the NBA put up with dozens of postponed games due to you know, COVID protocol issues, because the thought of trying to get everyone to go live at Disney World for 6 straight months and then play another playoffs there was just too much. It was untenable.
That's Ben Golliver, the national NBA writer for the Washington Post newspaper. Ben also has his first book out, Bubble Ball, a book about the NBA bubble last season in Florida. And we'll hear more of Ben's conversation with Dan Friedell later this week. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Join us on the next Straight Talk Africa. We're going to talk about Africans working abroad. Now, as economies around the world prepare to open after multiple lockdowns, will Africans be looking for jobs overseas again? And we'll bring you the stories of young people who chase their dreams abroad and their words of caution to others. We'll also take a closer look at what international migration will look like after the pandemic. Join us right here on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Thanks, Haiti. That's Haiti Adams, the new host of the VOA's Straight Talk Africa program. Straight Talk Africa is broadcast on Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC. Turning to tennis, the defending men's and women's champions are through to the quarterfinals at the French Open in Paris. Picking up the story is VOA's Gwen Uten. Sporty greetings, Gwen.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Men's defending champion Rafael Nadal easily advanced to the quarterfinals following his straight set victory over Italian 19-year-old Yannick Sinner. The clay court king has yet to drop a set at this year's French Open tournament, but he was challenged in the fourth round by the glare of the stadium lights that were turned on early quickly before the sun had gone down. And in his post-match interview, Nadal complained that the competing light sources bothered him throughout the match.
I thought the lights were on too early. And with the sun, you know, having a court like this that is all covered from one side, for me, from the right part of the umpire, the lights were bothering me a lot for such a long time. Now, when the sun was a little bit lower and the start to hit the lights was a little bit of, you know, was some shadows on the court, the sun hitting the lights, so have been a tricky situation. Honestly, I don't know why they put on the lights that early. We have been playing without lights here in Roland Garros for forever.
Nadal is looking to claim a record-extending 14th French Open title and become the only man to win 21 Grand Slams. He will next face Argentine Diego Schwartzman, who booked a spot in the quarterfinals after defeating German Jan-Lennard Struff on Monday. Elsewhere, world number one Novak Djokovic fought his way into the quarterfinals after he dropped his first two sets against another Italian 19-year-old, Lorenzo Musetti. Djokovic then staged a dramatic comeback that ended with his opponent retiring in the fifth set. Afterwards, Djokovic explained that he lost his opening sets due to a bad case of nerves.
I don't know, I just played under a certain kind of tension and wasn't able to go through my shots. Too many unforced errors and just not playing and not feeling great in the first couple of sets, but credit to him for playing well in important moments. After I lost the second set and went out to change and came back on the court, I just felt different. I was a different player. I've had better feeling in my shots. I had more confidence going through the ball. I decreased the amount of errors and started playing the way I was supposed to play at the beginning.
Djokovic is in the quarterfinals at Roland Garros for the 15th time. He will next face Italian Matteo Berrettini, who was handed a walkover following Roger Federer's withdrawal from the tournament earlier this week. Meanwhile, on the women's side, defending champion Iga Swiatek held off Ukrainian Marta Kostyuk to reach the quarterfinals. Swiatek has now won 22 consecutive sets and has played many more night matches at this year's tournament. And while she admits she needs more experience with playing under floodlights, she says she has adjusted to the pressure of defending her title.
After winning, obviously, I thought it's going to be much, much harder, but I feel ready right now. And after winning a Grand Slam, it's sometimes hard to come back and, you know, compete with the expectations. And hopefully I'm going to keep being consistent. And that's the most important thing for me. And I'm happy about that.
Swiatek will next face Greek Maria Sakkari in their quarterfinal match on Wednesday. If Swiatek goes on to win this year's tournament, she will become the first woman to retain the French Open title since 2007. And American teenager Coco Gauff has reached her first Grand Slam quarterfinal after defeating Ons Jabeur in straight sets. Gauff will next face Czech Barbara Krejcikova on Wednesday, and that is all from me. More tennis news to come. Back over to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten.
Yo, yo, yo. Sporty greetings, man. I'm Evelyn Akato, forward for the Tigress Nigerian Women's National Team and Flams Carolo Basket. Bonjour, bonjour, my people. You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evelyn. Finally, some more basketball news. Tom Thibodeau of the New York Knicks has been named the NBA's Coach of the Year. The 63-year-old Thibodeau led the Knicks back to the playoffs, where they lost in five games to the Atlanta Hawks in the first round. The Knicks finished the regular season with 41 wins and 31 losses. The NBA's Coach of the Year award is determined by a global panel of 100 sports writers and broadcasters who cover the league. wraps up the June 8th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.
I get it.